RKB 106.9 FM, la ràdio que t'envolta. 106.9 FM, 106.9 FM.
It's a beautiful
morning, Barcelona, and welcome to Thursday at English Radio on RKB 106.9 FM. I'm Virgil, and normally by this time of the year, we would have seen school graduations and plans for celebrating the summer. Well, like everything else in our world, COVID-19 has had its effect on education, teaching, learning, students, and parents. Joining us today to help us better understand the changes we've gone through and what we can expect going forward are two educators, authors, and education activists, former guest and friend Dr. Teresa Naves and her colleague Dr. Carmen Floret. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having
us. Welcome. Thank you
for having invited us.
My pleasure. Now, after having had several months of social isolation and in many cases homeschooling, I think many of us have a greater appreciation of the work being done by educators. How did you both come to this point in your careers, and why in Barcelona?
Well, I think that the two of us were born in Barcelona, and we live in Premià de Dalt. This is where we met, and we also met through the University of Barcelona. I'm a secondary school teacher. I ended up working at the university where I met Carmen, and she was then working on CLIL, an area that the two of us are very proud of. CLIL is basically the teaching of subjects through a foreign language like English.
Let's say that Teresa was my tutor, you know, okay, at the university. So she was taking care of my, I had to, a whole year.
A work leave.
Okay. Exactly.
Like a sabbatical?
Kind of.
It was a study. I was doing a study for the Ministry of Education here in Catalonia. So I was paid to do that for a year. I was very lucky. And Teresa was my teacher. She was the one that
one of the tutors.
Helped me.
Okay, great. Well, now, the profession of teaching often hasn't received the respect that it deserves in many countries. I can think of the U.S. for one thing. But do you think as a result of COVID, the perception of teachers will change for the better?
Well, I think that at the moment, parents know us better because we've been communicating with them during these 3 months through several ways, particularly telephone calls, video conferencing, and made it possible that everyone know each one better. So we know their houses, we could see their living rooms or rooms, and then they could see we are real people, not just a teacher, you know.
Right.
I think that this has been very, very important. However, I think that this will be very hard to be kept in the future. So we have to take care of that. So continue with this close relationship between families, with families and us.
Well, I think it's going to be important because the whole thing is that in a lot of ways, the Zooms, the WebExes, the FaceTime, all the rest of us have brought parents and teachers together in a meaningful way. And I think the key is going to be, you know, how do we structure the education going forward?
Yeah, and I think that this is a must because there is no tradition in general in this country of involving parents and families in the schools, unlike things that I've seen in the United States, for example.
So like parent-teacher conferences and all of that?
Okay. And I mean, it was the first time that we got letters and emails and calls from parents saying thank you.
Exactly.
I mean, and they really appreciate it. And something, I mean, most schools are in these programs called the quality that they keep a record of everything. Okay. But one one positive part of that was that the coordinator of quality was really pleased because she said, oh, you know how many calls I got? You know how many emails we got? You're really appreciated. I mean, and I think that this needs to be kept. And one of the things that we did differently in our school was that the assignments, the communication with the students was conducted so that the parents were also aware of the of the kids' load. So they had a kind of schedule, but not in which they could see where to connect, who to contact, where to find the information. So we made a lot of effort. So the first 3 weeks were really stressful for them and for us. But in the end, I think it pays off.
I think in the end, what you're doing is you're making parents teacher assistants.
Yes, this is what was happening during these 3 months of lockdown. And I can say that school can't work isolated and working against parents. Yeah. So this was the past. I mean, school is here, family is here, and in the middle were teachers. Mm. And we were thinking, no, parents can't come to school. No, why not? This is exactly the opposite. We should open our doors, and parents should...
We
wish they come to our classrooms and they can see what we do.
Maybe it will happen in the future.
And this is what research also points out, okay? Research shows that the most effective programs, those in which students excel, especially those that come from public state schools like ours, okay, with a degree of percentage of the population that is impoverished and excel and thrive, are the ones that have involved parents in the decision making and have kept parents informed of all the stages that the project entailed. And I think that this is something.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, we'd like to talk more with our guest right after this.
Looking for jazz on TV. Tune in and tune out, screaming and dreaming. I'm gonna be a star. On game shows where even losers win. On a good day in L.A. Late night tonight, bearded host, no women, no doubt. Staying up all night till a quarter to three. Looking for jazz on TV. Hipsters and cats, everything's melody, yeah, baby. I ain't talking smooth, that ain't never been cool. Things got a swing, or it don't mean a thing. Keeping it real. Staying up. Till a quarter to three, yeah, yeah. Looking for jazz on TV.
Some say that the air has come and gone. Believe me, baby, you got it wrong. I witness God, plenty of blues. But where's that sound, that sound that makes freedom ring? The kind of beat to the beat of music, the beat of music and the beat of swing. Ride that samba with a samba beat, screaming guitars on top of a beat bop bar. Turn up the heat, Coltrane and Miles back on the block, Ella Bird and Sarah around the clock, keeping it real. Staying up all night till a quarter to three. Staying up all night till a quarter to three. All night till a quarter to three, yeah. Looking for jazz on TV.
And that was Carmen Lundy with Jazz on TV. Well, the lockdown that we've been in and continue to in one form or another be in has forced us to embrace technology, even more so to do our job, to communicate with each other, and to educate our children and ourselves. While this has been a necessary thing, I question whether it's been good, because the progress comes at a cost of possibly leaving many students and communities behind. Now, Carmen, this has been a particular concern of yours, so tell us a little bit about it.
Yes. This has been a great concern from the very beginning, because we knew that several families didn't have any connection to internet, anything, and also any device apart from a mobile phone. Mm. Mobile phones has became the more important tool during lockdown, because it was the way to communicate with families, also the way to participate in video conferencing. But it's true that several families didn't have any possible connection until very late, until maybe, let's say, mid of May. Mm. Mid of May. So it's long time.
That's over a month.
Because the Department of Education tried to give them connection and devices, but it's been a very slow process. And we've been, please go to their homes and give them that, but it's been a very low process. And also I should say that technology, it's been an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And teachers, because now we're talking about families, but also we had to talk about teachers. Teachers speed up, and everyone now is involved working through technology. We had several teachers that didn't want to do anything related to ICT, you know. And now they had to, right. And they have to at the moment. So everyone had learned a lot. We've been learning a lot about that and work through that. And this is good news, really.
Well, I mean, the families that are, you know, lower income, you know, not everybody can still afford a laptop or whatever. And, you know, the best thing they might have is go to the library and use the computer at the libraries or the phones. But
libraries were closed.
Right.
So this was the possibility we always say to our students that don't have anything at home. Go to the library and there you can work for free. But during this time it was not possible. And there is something else to add. And it's important. Low-income families normally do not have a very high cultural background.
Right.
So their education is low as well. So this is one of the big problems we have. Because even though they could have devices or connection, they don't know how to help.
Right.
They can't help. This has been the concern, the second concern. The first, the connection, the devices. The second one was they can't help. Because language, maybe they don't understand the language.
Right.
That's a problem. That's a big problem, the first one. Secondly, because they don't have any level of education. I mean, maybe they didn't attend primary schools at their countries, so they came here without any education.
You mean basic background of things.
Basic, exactly. So this is something we have to tackle in the future. I mean, we have to have this aim in front of us. This is an aim for at least for our school, Santa Ana Primary School, Premia de Dalt. So yeah, because I started as a head teacher yesterday, 1st of July. So one of my and our big aims is to prepare a program, a special program for families and parents to learn. So like a parents' school,
okay.
Something similar.
Well, the thing is, you know, we talked a little bit about the idea of, you know, hopefully erasing or minimizing this digital divide. But as you're talking about it, it's more like a systemic problem that, you know, the culture of many people, of many societies, even within the society, if the desire for education isn't high, even though you have technology, it doesn't necessarily address it. So the thing you have to look at is, you know, you're going to have families who have money. They're always going to do well. They'll always do better because they'll have the access to everything they need. But now, how do we prepare those children, you know, who don't come from advanced, you know, wealth or higher socioeconomic status, how do we help them advance their education?
That's a very difficult question, and I'm afraid that we don't have an answer for that, because unfortunately the best predictor of how successful a kid is going to be is how wealthy their families are, how well educated they are. So poverty is an issue. And Stephen Krashen, for example, who advocates for reading for pleasure and the use of libraries and funding libraries, the fact that libraries are not as well funded as they used to be in wealthy countries like United States, results in kids coming from impoverished backgrounds and neighborhoods, not having access to education. So I'm afraid we don't have.
We don't have solutions,
but
we can do several things. I mean, it's not because we can't do anything. Yes, Teresa?
No, two things that I was writing down while you were talking is networking. Something that has worked, for example, is counting on people sharing their Wi-Fis. That was very easily done among students, okay, and in small villages, and it was also suggested in Premier that several groups. Why don't we make our Wi-Fi service available to our neighbors, and in this way at least, okay, and even in spite of the fact that the schools were closed, okay, so if the library could share, or the town hall, the city hall could share the Wi-Fi, this is one way of compensating. And the other thing is relying on networks, again, something that you were talking about, the mobile phones. So for example, at the beginning it was really discouraging to find out that 30% of the students didn't show up, okay? Mm. So I immediately shared my telephone number, which is something that I don't usually do with such young students. And I said, okay, those who volunteer, let's have a WhatsApp. It worked very well because they've got their own WhatsApp. So I said, okay, who's missing? Who's a friend of Nuria? Who can call and contact Nuria? So it wasn't me contacting her. I mean, I had tried, for example, and she may not have replied. But the minute that another classmate contacted those students that are struggling because of many different reasons, economic reasons in particular, we had some success. So
basically what we're talking about is really is you creating a community within the community.
Yep.
So that people who have the ability, who have the resources, can share them with the people who don't have them.
Exactly. It's something like that, creating networks.
Yes.
So, for example, in our case, we have immigrant families from Morocco, for example, so they don't have a good knowledge. They can't speak in Catalan or Spanish freely, just a little bit. So through telephone was hard. They didn't understand things. Yes, open that screen, try to do that. Was very, very difficult. But I think if we can create, we didn't be successful in that at that point. We tried, I mean, and we helped, but I think we should be aware of creating people in those communities that can represent them and make them participate with us in creating a bigger network so they can get involved and feel we're listening to them.
Right. One of the things that we did back in the States, again, looking at health messages, you know, to lower-income families who are at higher risk for disease and all that, we involved the churches and the mosques. And they then set up within the churches and the mosques study centers where the kids could come and use the internet and be able to do their homework and be able to have a place that was convenient and close and where they could get help. Some people who understand it. So conceivably, that may be another way of outreach.
Our town, we have something like that with the Catholic Church.
And remember the time that we invited Najat? Najat, she works at the Catalan in the
How do you say that?
Consellera.
deputy. Can we say that? Through elections.
And she comes from Morocco, and we went to this neighborhood where Carmen School is located. It is between Premia de Dal and Premia de Mar, and there is a high percentage of the students who come from Morocco or Algeria. And the minute they saw her talking to them in Arabic, It changed. They started smiling, and then she invited them to go to the Catalan Parliament. They were so thrilled. Okay, and I ride my bike, and sometimes they greet me, and I said, "How can they possibly remember me? I mean, I haven't met them, and it is through through
Najat.
Okay,
so what can we do?
Right. Yeah. So again, it's a matter of being creative. We'll be back to talk more with Teresa and Karma right after this.
I got to
And that was Diana Ross with I'm Coming Out. Now, we've seen and have a sense from the media that students are leading the way in a new acceptance of gender differences, LGBTQ rights, etc. Now, are you seeing this happening in your schools here?
Certainly. I mean, I remember last year that there were grade 8 students, and there were 4 of them demanding, requesting to the tutors, you know, I mean, these gender issues have not been dealt with properly. Our special needs as far as sexual orientation, gender, and talking about gender is not something that we do. Why don't you invite somebody that can help us in this regard? And they are very empowered girls, and they say, okay, you know, I'm bisexual, and
the teacher was listening.
Yeah, I can see the teacher says something. Okay.
And I'm non-binary, so the freaky one. Okay, or the gays friendly teacher that I'm associated with. Okay, so I got contacted and said, could you bring one of your friends? Meaning, okay, those who know. Okay, and I immediately contacted Kathy Payas, whom I think that you should consider for a talk on gender. She's great. She's the president of LGBT families, and she couldn't make it at the time. And we invited also a great professor from the University of Barcelona, a lawyer, Ricardo de la Rosa, who's the president of an association called ENYAS, and his PhD was in LGBT rights, but with the very old people, okay, people that have to go back to the closet because they retire. And he gave these 2-hour workshop, and students didn't leave, okay? Once, I mean, it was 2:30, and we said, okay, we have to leave. I said, no, but we've got questions for him. You're not going to make us leave, are you? I'd say that's a great success.
Okay, well, I think the whole thing is that you are recognizing them, and the fact that they sense that you're recognizing them gives them a willingness to buy in to the whole system, the whole process, and become part of it, and just say, all right, where do we go? But now, that's only one of the challenges you have today. I mean, in playing off of that, you know, you're going to see, unfortunately, the lack of acceptance of others, bullying, you know, teen violence and all of that. Obviously, digital information has been good in terms of helping to educate, but at the same time, it's been bad in terms of being able to provide images of things that aren't necessarily good for promoting a healthy society. How do you balance that with the kids to be able to say that, you know, all the things you see on TV or see on the internet or see in music videos are not good?
I don't have any plan for that. I mean, we try to. We think we should be working on that further and in deeper. And I think, at least until today, we've been teaching everything we could, as best as we could, but these type of topics were like something that was not, you know, try not to talk about it too much, because if you have differences in the classroom, maybe it's better not to say anything.
There wasn't a teacher's guide for it.
No. And this is what I mean.
And there is no teacher training about human rights, multiculturalism, inclusion. So we need the kind of teacher that I wish to grow up and end up being, like Jane Elliott, for example. Okay, Jane Elliott in the 60s did a great exercise. She dared to do something that I have always admired. When I've always show this video to my MA students.
Her blue eye, brown eye.
A class divided. She taught a lesson. But even the short talks that are available on the website now are really powerful. So, for example, the minute that it's got subtitles in Spanish, in which she addresses an adult audience saying, I'm going to give you the following instruction. Please stand up if you would like to be treated the way this society treats our black citizens. She waits, she pauses, and she says, nobody stands. You didn't understand my directions. I said, please stand if you would like to be treated. This society, and she emphasizes again, treats our black citizens. Nobody stands. I can see that you're aware of the problem. I'm wondering why you're not willing to take a stand to do nothing against that. And this idea of black citizens, which is very powerful, and she's totally right, can also be replaced by, what if we replace it, for example, with trans women? Would you like to be treated the way we treat trans people? But you need to, somebody who thinks in terms of how the learner's mind works and what it is effective and what it's not. So unfortunately, we do not have solutions, but we do keep trying. And I think that it is the trying. Last year, for example, I was amazed by a piece of work that one of our students ended up doing in relation to violence. We had been working on the importance of bystanders taking a stand, and she edited. And one of the videos that I selected, I spent a great amount of time trying to select input sources that I think may work with students, and that one worked, was these cadets, male cadets from a military school in the United States, taking a pledge, taking a stand, and they talk about their previous experience, and they basically said the message was very simple. I have been bullied, and others would say I bullied. And then the video changed from colorful images to them in white and black, and they basically said, in the future, I may be bullied, but I promise I will not bully.
Well, part of this is what is a matter of, we talked about in terms of developing a community, a support of the community, and then being able to have the young people themselves develop the community. But in part, unfortunately, even within their little communities at school or in their neighborhoods at home, they're still going to be exposed to the overall society and its biases and prejudice. So again, being able to give them the ability to look at these external influences and be able to adapt them is probably going to be an even greater challenge for you guys going forward.
This is a challenge. And I think society is so, I mean, our environment, the social environment is so strong. Schools, as we are small, little societies, and maybe inside school you try your best, and you can avoid racism, for example, and you treat everyone the same. But when once they cross the school gate, so outside it's free. I mean,
right?
And then it's the society, and our society is not really concerned on these type of things.
No.
And it's visible, and we can see that, because every day, or almost every day, we can see aggressions and people that is mistreated. So we apply a program that is an anti-bullying program at school, but even though we do that, I'm sure that we should do much more.
Well, it comes down to a matter of being able to recognize it and being able to see, can you intervene, or is it beyond the scope of what a teacher is supposed to do?
Yeah.
That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Well, you're listening to English Radio Thursday on Radio Canal Barcelona, 106.9 FM. We'd like to talk more with Teresa and Carmen right after this.
Another madman been struck again. Rain and fire across the ocean. Another madman been struck again. Sitting down here, fall out of shelter. Paint my walls twice a week. Sitting down here, fall out of shelter. Think about the slave long time ago. 10 million slaves across the ocean. They had shackles on their legs. 10 million slaves across the ocean. They had shackles on their legs. Don't know where don't know where, where they've been. Sun goes out, you'll be standing, you'll be standing by yourself. Sun goes out, you'll be standing, you'll be standing by yourself. 10 minutes late, cross the ocean, they had shackles on their leg. 10 minutes late, cross the ocean, they had shackles on their leg. Don't know where, where they're going. Don't know where, where they've been. Don't know where, where they're going. Don't know where, where they've been.
Otis Taylor with 10 Million Slaves. Now, the Black Lives Matter movement has seemingly galvanized young people around the world to support the causes of black people in America, as well as forcing European countries to face the participation in colonialism and the slave trade. Now, as educators, how do you teach about racism and its legacies? And again, we started talking a little bit about that in terms of the textbooks and the materials you have.
So, going far away from from textbooks, something that my school has decided, and I'm glad to that they have agreed and there is consensus about it, is that we're going to use one course book or one textbook for every to be shared for 2 years. This gives teachers the opportunity to implement other projects in addition to what the syllabus that is dictated, and the selection of the inputs. So things that we do in order to raise awareness about racial issues with the younger ones, and that was quite... They quite like it, is that whenever possible, we introduce Rosa Parks giving up, having been asked to give up her seat. And the way we do it, these are 12-year-olds, is that we take the chairs in the class, and we, using two chairs, a line of chairs represents the bus, and then they are given a card, and at random, they are given the role of being either white or black. And they can't possibly decide whether they are white or black. Okay, they are given at random. At random, we decide who's going to be playing Rosa Parks, who's going to be playing the bus driver, who's going to be playing the nasty guy who asked Rosa Parks to give up the seat and was annoyed. And the language we use is pretty basic, okay? It's not that we expect them to produce utterances and discourse, nothing of that sort, but we want them to experience what it was like. Well, and we reverse the roles.
Well, the problem with that is, how can they experience it if they've never experienced it? For example, if you've never been black, how do you know how to experience being black?
No.
You know, and this, it goes to the same thing. If you've never been white, how do you understand what white privilege is all about? other than having seen it in terms of what you don't have. So I think it's good to try to sensitize the kids, but again, being able to give them the appropriate tools to really play the role. Because again, if they've never felt deprivation, discrimination, and bias, it's almost a foreign concept in some ways. You know, they've seen it on TV and they can only guess at it. And I guess the question is, you know, how do you really make that real for them?
Yeah, but the rage that they feel, for example, for just because they are told, okay, if you're black, okay, you can't possibly sit in the same waiting room as the white folks from your class. If you're black, you have to go to the back of the bus. Some students rebelled, and I said, you know, Let's practice it. And they started saying, oh, but that's very unfair. Why can't I sit here? And all the rules, those who were white would say, oh, you know, no, the rules are very clear. Okay, so you reproduce some of the things and that take place. I'm not claiming that this is the solution, but I'm saying that it is an attempt. The other thing that we've done this year was, for the first time, we selected a book which is meant to be used with very young learners, a book about racism, which was written by an author, a British author, whose father is black and whose mother is white. This is his words, not mine. And it tells the story of growing up and being discriminated against because of the color of your skin. And I asked the students, I took the opportunity as an excuse of a pre-reading exercise, that was the pretext, okay, to gather previous knowledge, previous experiences, and their beliefs about the color of the skin. And guess what? Most of the students, the minute before reading, before or having listened to the story, that he says something like, I'm proud of the color of my skin. Okay, I ask kids, what color do you think it is? And do you think that this is out of pride, or is this is he feeling sad or happy? Most of them thought that it was sad, that the kid was sad when he said, I'm proud of the color of the skin. And my assumption, and this is just an assumption, is that, okay, if you have to state that you're proud of the color of your skin, is that there is something that you want to empower yourself in order to claim that you're proud of the color of
the skin. That you're different.
Yeah.
Now, the whole thing is that those are very good mechanisms to try to, you know, generate awareness and generate change. How do you measure effectiveness? Because for me, you know, every program must be measured in order to be able to say, all right, is this program working? Is it effective?
I think we don't have enough research to say we have been measuring that. We've been trying to implement programs like the ones I said, for example, the anti-bullying program, anti-racism program, but I don't think we are measuring anything afterwards, and we're not implementing it so strong enough to be able to make any measure. I mean, there are programs that are there. At school, you do it. I mean, this is not because we don't do it, we do it. But when they play on the playground, or when they go to a shop and they say, my name is, and you say an Arabic name, so I don't think everyone is looking at this person the same.
True.
So, and how do you tackle that? I don't know. Okay. But I know we have to At least empower them and say you have equal rights as to everyone else.
Yeah.
But measure, maybe yes, I agree. We should be thinking in ways of measuring.
Yeah, I think that there is an attempt.
Because again, you talk about research. Obviously, the outcome of research, you know, you have a hypothesis and you have expected outcomes. But again, if you don't measure the outcomes, was the research effective or not?
Yeah. Teacher, we don't have time to research. This is the first point.
No, the Generalitat is somehow attempting to do that.
Exactly.
Okay? There are those surveys, okay, that have been provided, and this is a great instrument, I think, for a long time, which is Enquesta de Convivencia, that can be customized. So if that survey was implemented on a regular basis, we could see whether there was any improvement, at least at the school level, at the school community, which I think it is one way to start.
Yeah, okay. I think now we are, even though these type of things and problems have long right. history behind, but I think now society is starting to raise awareness
right.
in general. So I think, like for women, for example, on the 8th of March, like for the Black Lives Matter, now it's spreading everywhere. So even though little students start knowing that. So I think this is the first step.
Okay.
I think you are just starting. So I think we would like to be
the threshold,
move forward and be faster. But I think that I'm happy because I think now this big movement, world movement, is starting to grow. And it that's is. Good news.
Well, you know, an associated concept with it, as you talked a little bit about it, is xenophobia, or the feeling toward refugees and migrants. Obviously, we have a lot of migrants and refugees in our school system today.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they don't look like, you know, most of the people who've been there. Now, we talked about some of the things the young people have done to, inculcate themselves into the system. Have the young people in general be able to understand the distinctions out here with xenophobia and be able to move past that, to embrace their colleagues, their friends, their fellow students, in ways they hadn't been before?
Yes, at school,
mm.
but outside school, I don't think it's just, I would like it to be better.
Right, right.
This is what I think. I don't know if Teresa would say anything else about that, but I think we're trying. And as I mentioned before, at school, students are treated the same. In the classroom.
Right.
But you never know in corridors, or you never know on the playground, even though you are talked, we are told. So
right.
This girl or this boy just said that to me, and then you try to address the issue and solve it. But even though we do our big effort, society.
Right. You can't change hearts and minds.
Not at the same time. No, not everything at the same time. But I think we're doing great, great progress.
Okay. We'll be back to talk more right after this.
Thank you.
Donny Hathaway with Someday We'll All Be Free. Well, you mentioned to me in your background piece the role of allies and bystanders and being able to enhance the adoption of the concept that we've talked about. Now, talk a little bit about this. Who are these allies and bystanders, and how can they change the mindsets?
I do hope that they can change it. I mean, there are many schools in Europe and in North America that have been implementing this, what they call clubs, ally clubs. This is an LGBT friendly school, LGBT friendly classroom. So I think that this could be extended to any minority, and this idea that we need to support each other. If we think of the civil rights movement in the States, it was clear that thanks to people from different religious backgrounds, different communities that took a stand, there was a turning point. And I think that LGBT, who happened to be a minority, rights would not have been possible to change the law had not it been that there were allies within the heterosexual community. So this idea of counting on each other, women's rights, I think that we have to expect much more help from our colleagues, our partners, male companions.
All right, but so an ally then is someone who is either of the same group or who has an empathy for that group.
Who's not necessarily from the same group. I mean, I do understand that the fights for the rights need to be led by those of the community, okay? So, but having said that, you can step aside, you can sort of help, you can be then a bystander. So if there is a racist comment, if there is a homophobic comment, you take a stand and say, what's the joke, okay? That's not clear to me. And this is a combination of having allies on the one hand, and also taking the role of a bystander, of an active bystander, somebody who sees something that is unfair, that is wrong, and takes a stand instead of saying, oh, that's controversial, you know, I better be quiet. This is something that may...
You're saying bystanders are not active in terms of addressing the issue?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, that's a fairly simple thing that can easily be understood. Now, you know, it's been, you know, wonderful having you guys on the show. You know, we could just have another hour or two to really talk about this. But if there was one thing you want to have the audience take away from today, what would it be?
Education is the key.
No question about it. No question about it. And I think probably the other thing is that you've alluded to is that parents need to become involved,
yep,
to be part of that education. You know, it's not just sending the kid to the school and letting the teacher take over. The parents have to be involved.
Building communities.
Okay.
Now, what you said before, communities within the community.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Now, what should a parent be doing, you know, to be able to help this process along? How can the parents help the teachers going forward? What would you want them to do?
I'd like them to participate at school, to give us their opinions about how we work and improve our way of working, and also going with us through the long process of educating their children. So being friends with us, yeah, not enemies.
Right.
And also, let's say, going in favor, I mean, in front of their children, saying the school is important, your teachers are important, please listen to them.
Perfect. Well, that's it for today, and we'll leave you now with a song to kind of sum up the lessons about our world and how we can change it. Bob Baldwin says it best, that we just have to imagine. Have a great one, Barcelona, and we'll talk to you next week.